Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dan Friedel and Gregory Stockel. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Dan Friedel.
Researchers have found a preserved body thought to be 800 years old in the South American country of Peru. The body was mummified. Mummification is a method used by ancient cultures to preserve the bodies of dead people. One archaeologist involved said the body is from the Lima area of the country. The discovery was announced last week. Peter Van Dalen Luna of the State University of San Marcos described the mummy. The whole body was tied up by ropes and with the hands covering the face, he said. He added that the process fits with other burials in the area. Van Dalen Luna said the person lived high in the Andes Mountains. It is not known if the body was that of a man or a woman. The next step is to use a process called radiocarbon dating to find a more exact date of when the person lived. The process measures the presence of a radioactive form of carbon, which lets scientists estimate the age of something that was once alive. Van Dalen Luna said the mummy was found outside of Lima in a burial place. The burial contained objects including stone tools, vegetables, and pottery. Peru is the home of the ancient city of Machu Picchu. It has hundreds of archaeological places where researchers are learning more about the Incan Empire, which ruled the area over 500 years ago. I'm Dan Friedel.
A new report says more than 100 international companies are at risk of selling cotton products made by Uyghur forced laborers in China's far western Xinjiang area. The report is called Laundering Cotton: How Xinjiang Cotton Obscured in International Supply Chains. It says China's industry hides where the cotton comes from. Researchers with the Helena Kennedy Center for International Justice at Sheffield Hallam University in England wrote the report. The researchers found that five major Chinese fabric suppliers are using cotton from the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region. The suppliers export their partly finished goods to international middle manufacturers. They then ship finished cotton products to companies all over the world, including the United States. The report mapped likely supply chains that connect Xinjiang cotton to over 100 international companies. Laura Murphy is the lead writer of the report. She teaches human rights at Sheffield Hallam University. She says around 85% of China's cotton is produced in Xinjiang, where leaders are accused of forcing labor on Uyghur people. Murphy told VOA that local Chinese officials push people, sometimes whole villages, to give up their land. They are then considered extra labor by the government and are made more vulnerable to state-backed labor changes. About 12 million Uyghurs live in Xinjiang. Since early 2017, rights groups and other experts estimate that over 1 million Uyghurs and other Muslim minorities have been detained in camps across the area. Rights groups have also accused China of forcing many Uyghurs into labor once they get released. The report says some of the places where the cotton was processed were nearby or within a prison or camp. China describes the detention camps as training centers. The Chinese government says the country does not force labor on Uyghurs, and its job training is to decrease poverty and help Uyghurs. Earlier this year, the United States banned the import of cotton products from Xinjiang. It says China uses forced labor in cotton production and other products. Zhao Lijun is China's foreign ministry spokesperson. He says that Uyghur forced labor is the biggest lie of the century, made by some Western countries to slow China's development. The report found that 52% of China's exported cotton products are shipped to 53 middle manufacturers in several countries. They include Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, Vietnam, Philippines, Hong Kong, Indonesia, Cambodia, India, Pakistan, Kenya, Ethiopia, and Mexico. The cotton-based clothing is then supplied to 103 well-known international companies. The report noted that many international companies may unknowingly be purchasing goods made by Uyghur forced labor. Murphy said companies need to follow where their materials come from to be sure they are not supporting an economy of forced labor. Murphy told VOA, "Sometimes suppliers may hide their sourcing or combine different sources of cotton." Murphy said some companies are actively investigating all of their suppliers to make sure that no Xinjiang cotton makes it into their products. Other companies, Murphy said, would prefer simply not to know. Not knowing, she added, is getting more difficult with international pressure, new research, and import legislation. Murphy added that there is no excuse for companies not knowing where their products come from. I'm Gregory Stockel.
Many countries are closing their borders as health experts continue to study the latest version of the coronavirus, the Omicron variant. On Monday, Japan became the latest country to ban all foreigners from entering the country. Over the weekend, Israel and Morocco announced that the countries are closed to all international travelers. Israeli citizens can come back to the country, but they will have to quarantine even if fully vaccinated. Australia said it would delay reopening the country to international students and workers for 2 weeks. The move came after the country reported its first cases of the Omicron variant of the new coronavirus. Across the world, the United States, Brazil, Britain, and the European Union announced travel restrictions from 8 African countries where the variant was first identified. The countries are South Africa, Botswana, Zimbabwe, Namibia, Lesotho, Eswatini, Mozambique, and Malawi. New cases of Omicron infection have since been identified in Hong Kong, Australia, Canada, and several European countries. Speaking from the White House on Monday, American President Joe Biden said, "Sooner or later, we're going to see cases of this new variant here in the United States. We'll have to face this new threat just as we face those that come before it." The president added, "The best protection against this new variant or any of the variants out there, the ones we've been dealing with already, is getting fully vaccinated and getting a booster shot." The variant was first identified on November 9th and reported to the World Health Organization on November 24th. 2 days later, the WHO designated the coronavirus variant B11529 a variant of concern, or VOC, and gave it the name Omicron. The health organization said Omicron has a large number of mutations, some of which are concerning. A mutation is a change in the genetic material of a virus. The WHO added that early evidence suggests an increased risk of reinfection with this variant as compared to other VOCs. Scientists still do not know whether the mutated versions could make it more dangerous. But the WHO said there is currently no information to suggest that symptoms associated with Omicron are different from those from other variants. Dr. Angelique Coetzee, a South African doctor who was one of the first to identify Omicron, spoke to Reuters. She said that symptoms of the variant were not severe and could be treated at home. It is also unknown whether currently approved vaccines or treatments will protect against the variant. Dr. Francis Collins is head of the U.S. National Institutes of Health. He told Fox News Sunday, "We do know that this is a variant that has a lot of mutations, like 50 of them, and more than 30 of those in the spike protein, which is the part of the virus that attaches to your human cells if you get infected." Collins added, "It does make you worry, therefore, that it's a sufficiently different virus, that it might not respond as well to protection from the vaccines. But we don't know that." On Friday, American drug maker Pfizer and its German partner BioNTech said new information would show whether their vaccine will have to be changed. The companies said, if necessary, they expect to be able to ship a new vaccine against Omicron in about 100 days. The Pfizer vaccine uses mRNA technology, which uses RNA genetic material to change cells. Moderna is the maker of the other highly effective mRNA vaccine. It said it is working on a booster designed to protect against several variants. And Johnson & Johnson stated that it was already testing their vaccine against Omicron. Vaccines, however, are still not widely available in poor and developing countries. In Africa, where Omicron was first reported, only 7% of the continent's 1.2 billion people have received the shots so far.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Abraham Lincoln did not live to see the final surrender of the armies of the Confederacy. A Confederate sympathizer shot the president at Ford's Theater in Washington on April 14, 1865. By that time, however, the American Civil War really was over. General Robert E. Lee surrendered in early April, bringing an end to 4 years of fighting. Several other Confederate armies were still in the field, but they were too small and too weak to continue the fight. Morris Joyce and Leo Scully tell the story of the final surrender of the Confederate armies.
One army was in North Carolina, commanded by General Joe Johnston. 5 days after Lee's surrender, Johnston asked for a meeting with General William Sherman, the commander of Union forces in North Carolina. Sherman met with Johnston a few days later. He offered him the same surrender terms that General Lee had accepted. He said the Confederates must give up their weapons and promise to fight no more. Then they would be free to return to their homes. Johnston said he could not accept these terms. Johnston said he had the power to surrender all the Confederate armies everywhere in the South. He said he would do so if Sherman agreed on a political settlement.
The two generals met again the next day. Sherman listened as Johnston explained his demands. Most of them Sherman accepted. He believed that President Lincoln wanted to help the South as much as possible. He had heard Lincoln say that he wanted to make it easy for the Southern states to return to the Union. When the agreement was completed, Sherman sent it immediately to Washington for approval by the new president, Andrew Johnson. The agreement seemed to give the South everything it wanted.
Instead of surrendering to Sherman, the Confederate armies would break up. The soldiers would return to their homes, taking their weapons with them. They would sign a promise not to fight again and to obey state and federal laws. In exchange for this, Sherman said the president would recognize state governments in the South which promised to support the Constitution. He said federal courts would be established in the South again. And he said the president, as well as he could, would protect the political rights promised to all people by the Constitution of the United States and the state constitutions. And Sherman said the United States government would not interfere with any of the Southern people if they remained peaceful and obeyed the laws.
President Johnson held a cabinet meeting to discuss the agreement Sherman had signed. War Secretary Stanton and the other members of the cabinet were violently opposed to it. They said Sherman had no power to make any kind of political settlement. President Johnson rejected the agreement. He said Johnston's army must surrender within 48 hours or be destroyed. He said the surrender terms could be no better than those given General Lee.
Johnston decided to surrender. On April 26th, his army laid down its weapons. One by one, the remaining armies surrendered. The soldiers began returning home. Many of them were bitter. They wanted to continue to fight. They spoke of guerrilla war against the Yankees. But most of the Confederate commanders opposed this. Many, like Cavalry General Nathan Bedford Forrest, urged their men to accept defeat. Said Forrest, in a farewell speech to his men, "It is a clear fact that we are beaten. We would be foolish to try to fight further. The government which we tried to establish is at an end. Civil war, such as you have just passed through, naturally causes feelings of bitterness and hatred. We must put these feelings aside. Whatever your responsibilities may be, meet them like men. You have been good soldiers. You can be good citizens."
Confederate President Jefferson Davis fled south after the fall of his government. He hoped to get across the Mississippi River. He believed that he could form a new Confederate army. If this failed, he planned to escape to Mexico. President Lincoln had hoped that Davis would escape. He felt that punishing Davis would only create more bitterness and make Reconstruction, the rebuilding of the South, more difficult. But President Johnson did not share Lincoln's feelings. He believed Davis had a part in the plot to kill Lincoln. He said, "Davis must be captured." On May 10th, Union forces found the Confederate president's camp in southern Georgia. They seized him and took him to Fort Monroe, Virginia. He remained there for many months under close guard. His trial was never held, and finally, in 1867, he was freed.
Late in May, 150,000 Union soldiers, representing every one of the Union armies, came to Washington. They came to take part in a big parade, a victory march through the city. For 2 days, the soldiers marched past the White House. Many of the marching men had fought at Bull Run, at Fredericksburg, Antietam, Gettysburg, Petersburg, and Appomattox. Sherman's Western Army was there, from battles at Shiloh, Vicksburg, Murfreesboro, Chickamauga, and Atlanta. The soldiers marched proudly past the president and other government leaders.
All along the way, from the Capitol building to the White House, were huge crowds of cheering people. Hour after hour, the soldiers passed. Never had the city seen such a celebration. Each group of soldiers had its band and carried its own battle flags. Some proudly carried flags that had been torn in fierce fighting. Finally, late on the second day, the final group of soldiers passed the White House. The grand parade was over. The battle flags were put away, and the marching bands fell silent. The war was ended. Now, men could look about them and count the cost of the war.
4 years of bloody fighting had saved the Union of States. The Northern victory had settled for all time the question of whether states could leave the Union. And it had put to rest the great problem of slavery, which had troubled the nation for so many years. But the costs were great. More than 600,000 men of the North and South lost their lives. Hundreds of thousands more were wounded. Many had lost their arms or legs.
The war cost the North almost $3,500,000,000. It was almost as costly to the Confederates. Most of the war was fought in the southern states, and most of the war damage was there. Hundreds of cities and towns suffered damage. Some, like Atlanta, were completely destroyed by Union forces. The damage outside the populated areas was almost as great. Union armies had marched across the South, leaving behind them widespread destruction. Farmhouses and buildings had been burned, animals and crops seized or destroyed.
Transport in the South was especially hard hit. Union soldiers had destroyed most of the railroads. The few Confederate trains that escaped capture were worn out from heavy use. Riverboats had been destroyed, and roads and bridges were in terrible condition. The South had no money to rebuild. Businessmen and rich landowners had put their money in Confederate bonds, now completely worthless. Confederate war debts would never be paid. There was also the question of the 4 million former slaves. They were free now, but few could take care of themselves. They needed jobs and training.
The people of the South faced a difficult future. They had been defeated in battle. Their economy was destroyed. In many areas, there was little food, and the people were hungry. Farmers could not plant crops because they had no seed and no animals to break the ground. There was no money for rebuilding. To add to all these problems, radical Republicans in Washington were demanding severe punishment for the South. Instead of offering aid, they demanded that the government sell the property of Southerners to pay Union war debts.
President Andrew Johnson, himself a Southerner from Tennessee, opposed the radical plans. He had his own program of reconstruction for the South.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.